Father, thank you for today, for the Sabbath, for this day when we can take the burdens off of the week, put them aside, and just be in your presence. Lord, I pray that you help us to open our hearts to what the Spirit has for us today. Teach us, and Lord, let me diminish so that you can increase here. In Jesus' name, amen. I want to ask you folks a question, and I want you to tell me something. What's your heritage? Where do you come from? As I stand here and look out into the congregation, I see different kinds of faces. And I'm curious, where have you come from in the world? What's your heritage? English, Trevor. Sorry? Adam and Eve, that's your heritage. So Middle Eastern, is that right? One blood. Joan?
South Africa.
South Africa. See, maybe you didn't know that Joan was from South Africa originally. Anyone else? Where's your heritage from? Irish. All right. Now you know who to look out for in the congregation, right? The fun one. Anyone else? Monte Carlo. There you go. Heritage, yeah. Ancestors back. Anyone else? Whereabouts?
Hungary.
Hungarian. American. Croatian. Anyone else? China. From China. Don't we have a varied congregation today? I'm very glad of it. You know, when you think about Australia, and it's funny, I noticed that no one said, oh, I'm original Australian. No one said that, and really no one can, because we are all immigrants. Every single one of us is either a first immigrant to this country or a descendant of an immigrant. We've all come to this country. Back in my history, I've got a great-great-great-grandfather who was Scottish and who worked a ship. He was a sailor, and he got to Sydney and liked it so much that he jumped ship and stayed. And because of him, I'm here today. He stayed in Australia for good. Each of us can trace a similar journey back through our history to someone who at some point decided to leave the place of their birth and travel to this country. Maybe you are even one of those people who decided to leave the place of your birth and to come here to Australia, to make this your home. Australia is to borrow a tired cliche, melting pot. We really are. A population is made up of people from every nation on earth. And yet immigration seems to be a hot topic of conversation all of a sudden in the media. It's in the papers, it's on the radio, it's on the television. And it makes me wonder what Jesus would have thought of it all. And I guess I ask myself, how should Christians act towards the situations we hear about? And how should we act towards those who want to come to Australia? Well, you know, Israel faced, I guess, similar kind of issues. And it's easy to think about the nation of Israel as one kind of homogenized group. Well, they're all Israelites. They're all Hebrews. They're all from one ethnic group. But that's really not true, is it? They weren't monocultural, they weren't even monoethnic. I mean, we know once they came out of Egypt, even Egyptians went with them and mingled among them. And when they got to the promised land, they certainly didn't hold themselves aloof. They traded, they had people come to live there. Many outsiders joined the nation of Israel, and God even had to make provision for that, because after all, didn't Israel know what it was like to be a stranger in a strange land? Hadn't they travelled through foreign and opposing enemy country after country just to get to their promised land? Weren't they immigrants as well? So God's laws started to reflect that reality and reflect the fact that within the borders of this nation of Israel lived strangers, people who had joined themselves to Israel. And we're going to have a look at what God says about these people in Deuteronomy. So come with me to Deuteronomy 24. And we'll start at verse 14. Do not take advantage of a hired man who is poor and needy, whether he is a brother Israelite or an alien living in one of your towns. Pay him his wages each day before sunset, because he is poor and is counting on it. Otherwise he may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin. Do not deprive the alien or the fatherless of justice, or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I command you to do this. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you are slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. And when we look at this, the first couple of verses there, verse 14 and 15, God comes right out and says it. Do not oppress a servant who is poor and needy. It doesn't matter who it is. It could be one of your brother Israelites, who you're related to by blood. Or it could be just Joe Blow who wandered in from Assyria. And we're talking about aliens as in strangers, people who don't follow the way of God. If they're within your gates, if they belong to your country, if they're where you live, you are supposed to look after them and not oppress them. What's it mean to be oppressed? I doubt any of us have ever really been oppressed in our life. Maybe some of you have. But being oppressed means to be subject to harsh, burdensome, and unusual conditions. It means to have someone treat you cruelly. And that word gives you the clue. Being oppressed is about being pressed down over and over again, carrying a burden that is so extreme that you cannot bear it. It's very easy to oppress the poor and needy, isn't it? That's why God singles them out, because they're the people who are least likely to complain, because they're so grateful to have anything. They're in such need. Now, I don't know if you saw in the news a few weeks ago, riot police in the United Arab Emirates responded to reports of a riot at a construction site for a Sheraton hotel. And when they got there, what had happened is that these workers had wanted to take a break, but their supervisors had told them not to, that they weren't allowed to. And so they rioted. And when I looked into it, I realised that there's human rights groups who have spoken vehemently against hundreds of thousands of slave labour people that are stuck in the United Arab Emirates, building these high-rises in Qatar. Their passports get taken away. They travel from very poor countries like Nepal. They work from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. every day with a one-hour break. Can you imagine that? They get given the princely sum of around $200 a month for that work, $50 a week. And look, the people who've gone there from Nepal, this is fact, they've noticed that Nepalese workers die at the rate of about one per day because it's unskilled labour. They're working on these high-rise buildings. One person a day is dying working in these conditions. This is oppression. Workers that have been interviewed have stated that they come to Qatar looking for work. They come looking for some money so they can send it back to their families. But when they get there, they realise they have their passports taken away, they can't leave. They get put in substandard accommodation. And they've got accommodation that would fit around 1,500, but they've got 10,000 people in there. They've got no health care. And they get a minimal wage to send back to their family. Some people are lying to their family. They say, I can't tell my wife what's happened, because she would cry. She would be too upset to know that I'm being oppressed. There is no way that they can escape. They've lost all rights. Some people have even paid money for a job coordinator to put them in this job, and then they realise they have to pay that money back. They've got to work for 4 years just to be able to pay that money back. It's very oppressive, and it's easy to oppress the poor and needy when they are foreigners. Because after all, who's going to stand up on the foreigners' behalf? Who's going to stand for them? Well, no one. They're strangers in a strange land. They've got no friends. They've got no support. But God says no. If there's someone who's a stranger to your land, he deserves to be treated the same as an Israelite. He needs to get the wages that he works for each day. In fact, he says if he's had those wages held back, then he could cry out to me, even if he's a stranger, and I will hear him, and it will be a sin against you. God is just, and God is fair, And God wants the worker to get his wages. He says so in James 5. He says in James 5 verse 4, "Look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty." God is saying that the laws that he is giving apply equally to Israelites, his chosen people that he has brought out of Egypt with his own hand, and foreigners. God is equal opportunity beyond a fault. Because really God doesn't see the difference, you know. We as people are very good at creating groups. We're very good at creating social groups, special groups, cliques, Facebook groups. We're all about putting people into boxes. And I don't know if you've ever met anyone for the first time, but usually you ask them a few questions. Where are you from? What do you do? You start putting them into a little box to figure out where they belong, to figure out who they are. We ask constantly about people's ethnicity, their work, their social habits, their hobbies, just to put them in a little square so we know whether we should be talking to them, I guess. To find out if they're in a higher or lower position than us. But God doesn't see those distinctions. God doesn't see a difference at all. Romans 2:11 says this, "For God does not show favoritism," or like the way the KJV puts it too, "God is no respecter of persons." You know, I used to think that made God sound a bit snobby, that God didn't respect anyone, like he was this kind of some cavalier, you know, "I don't care about you, I don't respect you." That you'd be trying to do good for God and do something noteworthy to please him and he just would cast it aside because he didn't respect you. But that's not what it means. It means that he doesn't recognise these artificial distinctions that we've created. He doesn't recognise them. Not when it comes to people. It means he doesn't care if you're the CEO of Chelsea with all the money and power that entails, or if you're a disease-ridden homeless person of the lowest caste in India. He sees you both exactly the same. The same because we are children of God. We're created equal in his eyes. Unfortunately, the world isn't that way, is it? I don't know if you heard last year in June, a young 16-year-old called Ethan Couch decided to take his father's pickup truck. This is in America. And he decided to go and steal some alcohol with his mates. They went and they got completely drunk. And as he was driving along, he turned around a corner and hit another two cars. Four people died that he hit. None of his friends or him were hurt. And that's terrible, and that is bad, but here's the worst thing. His lawyers argued that this boy was rich. His parents were multimillionaires. He had had everything that he ever wanted. So his lawyers said, because he's so rich, he doesn't really know the difference between right and wrong. Because he's had everything that he ever wanted, he didn't know that he couldn't take that car and get drunk and drive around. You know how much jail time he got? None. He got off on probation. They call it affluenza, the disease, if you have that. If you're rich, rich people can pay to get out of jail. But God is not like that. God's laws are fair and just. He says the same law applies to everyone equally. And God is happy to remind Israel why it should be so. Have a look at verse 22 here, back in Deuteronomy 24. "Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this thing." God is saying that there's not one set of laws for Israel and another set of laws for outsiders. Laws are to apply to all because they know, Israel knows, and they should remember well. It wasn't that long ago that their entire nation was slaves in Egypt. They know what it's like to be an outsider, to be living in a country that is not your own, to have no rights. They know what it's like. They remember it from Egypt. They've got first-hand knowledge of what the Egyptians put them through. What did the Egyptians put them through? Let's have a look at Exodus 1 while we're here. Exodus 1. Were they oppressed? Exodus 1 and verse 8. Keep your finger in Deuteronomy. "Then a new king," this is Exodus 1 verse 8, "who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. Look," he said to his people, The Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. And they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. I come down to verse 22, the ultimate oppression. The Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: every boy that is born you must throw into the river, but let every girl live. Can you imagine telling these midwives to throw away every male Israel child that was born into the river? This is oppression that they're living under. They were given work that was oppressive and harsh. They know what it's like to have their freedoms taken away from them. Have you ever felt like an outsider? Have you ever felt like you just didn't fit? I remember travelling through Indonesia in my early 20s. And this is the first time I'd ever been overseas. It was fantastic. I'd gone and got a credit card for the first time, completely innocent of what it entailed, or that I'd have to pay it back, and booked myself a ticket to go to Indonesia, because that's where you went, right, in the 80s and 90s. Bali. That was before the bombing, right? Bali was the place where all Australians went. And I was filled with excitement. It was a different country. And Bali was great. It's very relaxed. Most people there are Hindus, and it's very interesting. But we also went through Java, which is an Islam-based country. I guess the island is more Muslim. And there was a little different. There was a lot more military. And it was, very strange to listen to the sounds in the morning with the call to prayer. And I went out to lunch at a nearby shopping mall. And, I went with this group called Intrepid Travel. And they'd take you off the beaten path. And so we'd been in little villages. And it was great. But then we got to this town called, it's basically called Yogyakarta. And we lived there. And I went to this shopping mall. And I got some food and sat down. And for the very first time, I realised that I was the only white face around. Now, that might be not a big deal, but think about it. That had never happened to me before. Anywhere that I'd ever been in Australia, I was in a majority. Anywhere that I'd ever gone, I had people who spoke my language that I could communicate with easily. But as I sat there, I realised that I was alone and far from home, in a country where I knew no one, in a country where I didn't even speak the language, and most people didn't speak mine, full of people who didn't know me, who wouldn't really care about me. The feeling was eerie. I wasn't scared, I'm not trying to say that, but it made me realise what it must be like to be far from home and alone. By giving his people the command to love the foreigner, God's trying to establish something important. And you know what, he talks about it a lot. Come have a look in Leviticus as well. Leviticus 19. This theme is through God's commandments again and again. Leviticus 19:33. When an alien or a foreigner lives with you in your land, do not mistreat them. The alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you are aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. God is saying this again, because of the slavery you went through in Egypt, you've got to remember what it's like to be in that situation. How can you reject those who come now to you in the same situation? God commands Israel to treat the foreigner fairly, and he's done that on the basis that they were once foreigners themselves. But God doesn't stop there. In Deuteronomy, he goes further, and he makes provision for these people. Verse 19, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. Same with the olive trees. Same with the grapes of your vineyard. You shall not glean it. It will be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. Now, God makes provision here for those who cannot look after themselves. This is an early form of dole payment, right? Because these people who come from outside don't own land. Now, Israel was an agrarian society. And yes, they couldn't own land because the Israelites owned all the land. It was given to them by God. So how do you feed yourself? God makes provision for it. And notice, a little different from our system these days. The crops that a farmer gathered were his living wage. That was all that he had. He took most of it but left the rest. But when we get, I guess, our wage, we tend to parcel everything out for ourselves first. And then if there's any left over, we might help others. But God made the poor and needy a real priority. He cares for those who cannot help themselves, the stranger, the fatherless, the widows. Come back to Leviticus with me. We're nearly there. Leviticus 25. I just want you to get a grasp of how often God speaks about this. Leviticus 25 and verse 35. If any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and stranger so they can continue to live among you. Do not take interest or any profit from them, but fear your God so that they may continue to live among you. You must not lend them money at interest or sell them food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Again, God removes these barriers and makes a way for the foreigner, the stranger, to be treated just as well as his own people. He's trying to create a community here. Not a closed community of Israelites, of his people, but an open nation whose light was to shine. Can you imagine back in those days having a country that would treat you like that? Do you think the other nations would treat you like that? No way. Where would you want to go? You'd want to go there. Because they treat you like they treat their own people. Imagine that. Imagine the blessing that would be. Look, Deuteronomy 24, I believe, reveals God's character. He instructs his people to show the same love to the foreigner as they show to the countrymen. He reminds them of the good that they have and the safety they have now is a gift from him. He reminds them that once they were the same. And when we contrast the way that our country treats foreigners, those who come here, with these instructions that God has given, well, there seems to be a contrast, doesn't there? I wonder what would have happened if my great-great-great-grandfather had tried to come to Australia now. Proverbs 14:31 for our final verse here. He who oppresses the poor, that's Proverbs 14:31. He who oppresses the poor shows contempt for their maker, but whoever is kind to the needy honours God. The trouble is these artificial barriers that we put up. Us, them, mine, theirs. These are barriers that are human created. They're not God's barriers. John Stott, famous theologian, explains this very well. He says this: it is important that a church which has a passion for justice should stand up against any culture or system which overlooks injustice, especially when it refers to the weaker members of society. Yet such injustice goes further. It denies the very roots of the creation story as affirming each person as made in the image of God and worthy of dignity and respect. And it makes me ask, what role should we have when it comes to standing up for the oppressed in our country, or even the oppressed who are trying desperately to get to our country? Should we draw a line and separate ourselves from them? God never does that. He's no respecter of persons. He sees all of us as worthy of the love and care. Should we just ignore the whole thing and let Canberra work it out for us? Well, in reality, remaining neutral is an illusion. In a recent Record editorial, I'm not sure if you've read this, by James Standish, he said this: doing nothing in the face of social evil is not neutrality, it's complicity. Passivity in the face of human need is not faithfulness, it is sinful indifference. This is why it puts it this way: many deplore the wrongs which they know exist, but consider themselves free from all responsibility in the matter. This cannot be. Every individual exerts an influence in society. As Christians, we are called to stand for the oppressed. We are called to make our voices heard. We are responsible for the actions of those who represent us. And I'm not talking about politics here, I'm talking about people. people who are in need. What would Jesus say about this whole situation? A lot, I think. He said a lot about it. Do to others what you would do, what you would have them do unto you. He might tell us the parable of the Good Samaritan and ask whether we are loving our neighbour. He might ask whether we are praying for our enemies. I think Jesus knows most of all what it's like to be rejected by those that he went to. And so I wonder what counsel he would give us today. Please, I want to just state that I'm not trying to preach a political sermon here. I'm not going to stand up for either party, but I'm going to stand up for the people who are oppressed and who are being oppressed in my name. And I think that Jesus did the same thing. And I pray that we can show the same love to the stranger, to the foreigner, that we would like to be shown ourselves.